for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm, former managing editor of the New York Times. Clifton Daniel once claimed, "No woman will ever be an editor at the New York Times." It took half a century, but Jill Abramson has proven him wrong. She was named executive editor of The Gray Lady just last month. But journalism is just one of her passions. She's also devoted to her white-haired golden retriever. Jill Abramson has written a new book, part memoir, part investigative report, detailing her first year with Scout. The book is titled The Puppy Diaries, and Jill Abramson joins me in the studio. I'm sure many of you can relate to what Jill writes about in developing not only a relationship with Scout, but trying to help him understand the rules of society. Welcome, Jill. Glad to see you.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You can join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jill, congratulations on proving Clifton Daniel wrong.
Thank you, Diane.
He wasn't the only one.
No, that's for sure. I love looking at, there's some documentary footage of old Page One meetings from the 50s and 60s. And it's, you know, six men, most of them smoking in a room, deciding what will be on the front page of the New York Times the next day.
And, of course, Scottie Reston was also one who declared no woman an editor.
He was, I think, would be quite surprised to see me in this job, for sure.
In the midst of this extraordinarily busy career that you have had and have, how did this particular book come about?
It came about as an online experiment originally when I was managing editor of the Times. Two editors made an appointment to see me to talk about expanding pet coverage in the Times and to talk to me about whether there was a Timesian way to write about dogs and other pets. And we had just gotten Scout. And I was bleary-eyed, you know, sleep-deprived, kind of a nervous wreck. And instead of soliciting their ideas for how we could expand coverage, I deluged them with anecdotes and funny stories
about your own dog.
And they just looked at me and they said, you should write about this, Jill. And online, I started a column called The Puppy Diaries.
I love it. Now, when you talk about Scout, Scout was not the first dog. There was Buddy, a West Highland Terrier. And you really touch on the grief you experienced at the loss of Buddy.
Which I think is, you know, a difficult thing for many people. And it's one, you know, that you worry that if you talk about it with your friends or other people, they're going to think you're kind of kooky.
And sappy and
yeah,
all the rest
like,
of it.
You know, it's just a dog.
Yeah.
But, you know, as anyone who has a dog or has had a dog knows, you know, the human-dog bond is a very real and intense one. And, you know, Buddy had brought so much pleasure and joy into our lives and lived to be 16. He, you know, lived with us here in the Washington area and, you know, was with me when I was Washington bureau chief of the Times. And then when I became managing editor, he became a Manhattan boy.
Did you take buddy to work with
you? I did once, and it did not please some of my colleagues. So I got turned in to the building patrol and was told in a very nice way, no dogs allowed.
Too bad, too bad. In the midst of loving Buddy, and in the midst of having lost your father, you also had a terrible accident.
I did. It's true. And, you know, I have to say, compared to the terrible accidents that other people I know have had, this one was not, you know, terrible in the scheme of things. And I'm completely recovered now. But I was actually run over by a truck in Times Square.
Run over by a truck.
And I'm a lifelong, you know, born and bred New Yorker, you know, and have always been incredibly careful crossing the street. I'm really not one of those people who's always in a hurry or looking at my cell phone when I'm on the street. So this came out of the blue, and, you know, I broke a lot of bones. I was in the hospital in intensive care for some weeks, and then I had to learn to walk all over again. I broke my femur, which is one of the largest bones in the body, and other bones. And, you know, I was a mess for a while.
And where was your dog?
The sad thing is that Buddy had passed away in March of that year. It was 2007, and this accident happened in May. So, you know, I was still in my very blue period following Buddy's death and feeling a little lonely because, you know, my kids at that point were out of the nest. My son actually graduated from college the day before I was run over. But, you know, a house that had been full of kids and a dog was suddenly kind of quiet. And I was sad about that, but probably lucky because, you know, just to learn to walk again took months. And, you know, I wouldn't have been capable of walking a dog during that period.
Of course. Then your husband, your family urged you to get another dog, but you were reluctant.
I was. I just felt unready, and, you know, I felt I could never love another dog the way I had loved Buddy. And, you know, I just thought, here, you know, I have this incredibly busy job as managing editor of the Times, where I have to sometimes pick up and run into the office. And so why not enjoy like an empty nest and not having to take care of other people and constantly look at my watch and wonder how long has the dog been home alone, and I have to run back and, you know, walk the dog. And you know, my family began a very intensive lobbying campaign. It was on all fronts. Henry, my husband, had fallen in love with friends of ours' dog, who was also a white golden retriever. And he loved that she loved to swim and fetch and, you know, was so playful and well-behaved. My son started emailing me at the Times, like hopelessly adorable pictures from pet finders. My daughter, you know, made dates to look at shelters and thought up cute names for a new dog. It was relentless, and it worked.
And it finally worked so that you went to a breeder.
Mm-hmm.
You saw these puppies.
A litter of irresistible puppies. When anyone now says to me they're going to a breeder just to look, I always think, forget about it.
That's
There's
what
no
I told
way.
My husband as well.
But, you know, we were careful to go to a very reputable breeder, Diane, because as a fellow dog lover, I know you know that overbreeding is a terrible problem. Puppy mills are an awful problem. You know, many pet shops who still sell puppies get their puppies from pet mills. So it's important, you know, for both for the health of your dog and for other reasons too, to make sure you know that the breeder you're going to is reputable. So
did you at all consider adopting from a shelter?
I did, because, you know, Buddy was a West Highland White Terrier, so we got from a breeder too long ago. And, you know, I was certainly aware of how many dogs need homes, and, you know, although not as many as were in the past euthanized, you know, there are dogs still being put to sleep. And, you know, I did not necessarily have my heart set on a puppy, but my husband did. My husband had just fallen in love with the dog of our friends. And because I dawdled for so long, he took matters into his own hands and sent an initial application to the breeder.
Now, you do have Scout, a beautiful white golden retriever. You are now executive editor of the New York Times. Do you take your dog to work with you?
Still not allowed. I would love to. And I think that she would add a lot of fun and relaxation to our newsroom. But, you know, it's not permitted.
It's simply not permitted.
So that's sad. I have friends who do bring their dogs to work. And a little birdie told me, Diane, that Maxie occasionally makes appearances right here at your studio.
Not anymore, Jill. Not anymore.
I heard that she may have been banned recently.
Poor Maxie. Poor Maxie. Jill Abramson is with me, and her new book, The Puppy Diaries, is all about raising a dog named Scout. When we come back, we're going to talk about raising other issues at the New York Times. Welcome back. If you've just joined us, Jill Abramson is with me. She is executive editor of the New York Times. She is also a great lover of dogs. And her newest book, which began as a series in the New York Times Online, The Puppy Diaries, is now in a book, and she is talking about her white golden retriever, a dog named Scout, whose photograph is on the cover, and she is really just absolutely adorable. You, Jill, have a reputation as a tough editor, and yet, as Ken Auletta wrote in The New Yorker, I mean, this soft side of you is coming out in this. Is anybody going to take advantage of that, do you think?
Well, I don't think they probably will try to take advantage. But, you know, back when I worked worked in Washington, D.C., you know, I was well known for writing tough investigative pieces. And I remember occasionally, because at that point my children were small, saying to people who were turning down my request for interviews because I was supposed to be so tough and digging so deeply, I would sometimes say to them, but I'm a Girl Scout troop leader, which I was. I mean, I think the thing about journalists, like any professional, is that there are many sides and many dimensions to people, and they're not all one thing.
You did write a book with your dear friend Jane Mayer about Clarence Thomas after his confirmation. He is now, celebrating his 20th anniversary. What are your thoughts today about Clarence Thomas?
Well, my thoughts have turned to that time period because actually this past weekend was just the actual 20th anniversary, and there was an interesting symposium on the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings at Hunter College. And, you know, I think the lasting legacy of that, you know, controversy is, number one, you know, a lot of women were elected to the Congress in 1992. The hearings were in 1991. And that tableau of the all-male Senate Judiciary Committee just seemed so out of touch to many Americans. So in 92, there were six women elected to the Senate. They were called the Anita Hill class. What I think of Justice Thomas is that, you know, he is certainly a reliably conservative vote on the court. His jurisprudence, is pretty much in line with some of his other colleagues like Scalia and now Justice Alito and others. He had famously a sign up during his early days as a justice, because when he was having his confirmation hearings, it was said that Clarence Thomas would surely evolve on the court. And he had a little sign on his desk that said, "I ain't evolving." And, you know, he has been amazingly
consistent.
Yes.
Do you still believe he lied about relations with Anita Hill?
What I do believe, having spent, you know, literally years with Jane Mayer, who's one of the best investigative reporters in the business, she now works for The New Yorker, but we spent years researching every nook and cranny of this story, and we found other women who described incidents of Clarence Thomas saying bizarre things to them, just of the kind that Anita Hill testified about. And we found patterns in his life that gave credence to what she came to Washington and told about. So we felt the weight of the evidence supported her.
And what would you say about his wife's call to Anita Hill?
Right. Actually, the Times broke that story. And, you know, it was an odd occurrence where Ginny Thomas, out of the blue, after all of these years, called Anita Hill to say, like, you should really look at yourself deeply and consider, like, taking back the lies that you told. And, you know, Anita Hill was concerned enough by this bizarre telephone call that she teaches at Brandeis, and she called the campus police. But, you know, I think that at the point that, and I don't like to conjecture because as an investigative reporter, one always goes by the facts. But the facts at that moment were the Times actually had a front page story that very morning about Mrs. Thomas and some of her lobbying and political activities. And that was the same morning she made the call. So
do you see some connection?
I don't know. Possibly. I mean, the report reporter in me is intrigued by that. I wish I had enough time to spend still reporting that I could get to the bottom of that.
How did you end up at the New York Times to begin with?
I had been for many years, as I said, an investigative reporter at the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau, and I was their deputy Washington Bureau chief. And in 1997, I was attending a book party, and I ran into Maureen Dowd, the fabulous, brilliant columnist. And Maureen and I had actually sat across from each other at the Thomas Hill hearings. And, you know, we were not close friends, but acquaintances. And Maureen came up to me at this book party and said, "We're getting a new Washington bureau chief. And do you know any good women we can hire?" And I sort of gave her a look like, what am I, chopped liver?
Right.
And she kind of squinched up her eyes and said, "You would never leave the Wall Street Journal." And
I would said, you?
Well, you know, the new bureau chief came calling, and Joe Lelyveld, who is then the executive editor, made me a very attractive offer. And I'd grown up in a New York Times loving household.
Where there were actually two newspapers.
There were, for some years, two home subscriptions. Because my mother was an expert puzzler, and she didn't like other people to be fussing with the newspaper. But I fell in love with reading, and certainly reading newspapers growing up with the New York Times.
So. Jill, how did you get along with Hal Raines?
Diane was like 10 years ago. He was the executive editor and became so right before 9/11. And, you know, I learned some valuable things from him. We had some conflicts, but 10 years is a long time. I don't like going back over that territory.
I understand that. So now you have become the first female executive editor at the New York Times. Does the fact that you are the first female affect how you think you approach your work?
Well, you know, it has to affect how I approach my work as it affects who I am. And I'm immensely proud to be the first woman. And when Arthur Sulzberger Jr. announced my appointment, I talked to the newsroom and cited, you know, all of the women who battled in journalism and at the New York Times to make way so I could be a contender for this job. And then actually get the job. And, you know, that galaxy includes Nan Robertson, who wrote a book about women at the Times and in the profession called The Girls in the Balcony. You know, I thank Maureen Dowd, who has, like, been the most intrepid friend and supporter of mine, Janet Robinson, our CEO, a lot of the top people on our business side who I work with a lot are women, very strong women, and I couldn't be prouder.
Didn't Nan Robertson also write that extraordinary piece about toxic shock?
She sure did, and she won a Pulitzer Prize for it.
She won a Pulitzer Prize for it.
But in terms of, you know, the historical aspect of being the first woman, I keep in my office a very large photograph that's framed of the Times newsroom in 1905. And there is one woman. She was the second woman hired to be a reporter. And I think because the men were being polite, they gave her a seat sort of at the center of the desk that they're posing at. And she actually looks like the boss.
I love it. I love it. Now, the question that I'm sure a lot of people are wondering is there any connection between the kind of training you and Scout had to do together and the lessons you might apply to your work at the Times?
I think that there are life lessons in everything that one sometimes brings to work. And the the quality that I don't like about myself as a journalist is I can sometimes be impatient. And in child rearing or caring for a puppy, patience is just unbelievably important. If you don't have it and work on having more of it, you're not going to help either your dog or your children. And at the times I've found like I've had to learn to listen more and talk less.
Listen more and talk less. And that is serving you well.
I'm trying.
Jill Abramson, she's executive editor of the New York Times. Her new book is titled The Puppy Diaries, Raising a Dog Named Scout. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Greg in Orlando, Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
Thank you for your show.
Thank you.
I'm on the cell phone. I hope I stay alive here.
I do, too. I hope you're not driving.
Oh, unfortunately, I am.
Oh, and, dear.
My question actually relates to safety. I was run over by a garbage truck as a pedestrian, so my curiosity is greatly piqued. And my question is, did it contribute, her accident contribute to her independent thinking as it relates to her will to live?
That's a very thoughtful question, and I'm just not sure. I think my accident taught me a lot of things about myself.
Such as?
Determination and patience, because you don't recover quickly from something like that. And you learn, you know, in any setback, either personally or professionally, you learn what you're made of, and you grow.
Tell me exactly how that accident occurred.
It was early one morning in May 2007, and I was actually on my way to exercise before work near the Times Building in Times Square, and the light changed, and I started crossing 44th Street, headed to the gym, and, you know, this truck came out of nowhere fast and ran over my right foot first. And for some reason, I was dragged down into the gutter, and then the rear wheel of the truck went over the top of my left leg and did the most damage. And a policeman and a doctor at Bellevue Hospital, where I was taken, said to me that if the tire had been inches higher, I would have been killed.
Wow. Did the truck stop?
The truck actually didn't stop, but, you know, it is a nice story about Manhattan in that tons of people who were crossing in the opposite direction stopped to help me when they saw what had happened. And several of them chased the truck and stopped it. And I don't know to this day whether the driver just didn't see me or what.
So you don't know if it was a deliberate case of hit and run.
I don't.
Yeah. Did you ever meet the driver?
I saw the driver once, but didn't meet him.
Yeah. How long did it take you to recover?
Well, I was in Bellevue Hospital, where, you know, they have one of the great trauma centers in the world. I was there for 3 weeks, and then for about 3 months, I did intensive physical therapy every day, and I graduated from being in a wheelchair. I was in a wheelchair when I returned to work at the Times, to crutches, to a cane, to, you know, maybe 6 months out, being able to walk, still limping, unassisted. And, you know, I'm incredibly lucky. Yeah. There are so many people who have awful accidents or head injuries, you know, who don't recover. So I feel I have everything in the world to be grateful for.
Do you think it taught you anything about slowing down?
Maybe slowing down. I've never been a rush yeah, person.
Right.
I'm not addicted to looking at my email or text messages. But it definitely makes you stop and think that, you know, something could happen to you at any moment, and you better make the most of the time you have on this earth, for sure.
For sure. And I must say, in this changing media landscape where you are constantly barraged mm-hmm. with email, with tweets, with Facebook. Are you on Facebook personally?
I'm not. I am on Twitter, and I've mostly been reading, but I have tweeted, and my children, who are now in their 20s, have given me a very low grade on Twitter. They say I don't get it.
Jill Abramson, she is executive editor of the New York Times. Her new book, The Puppy Diaries, will take just a short break and come back with your calls and comments.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. And by ESET, offering home internet security with parental controls to fight spam, viruses, and cybercrime. ESET.com. This is NPR.
After 35 years as a Supreme Court Justice, John Paul Stevens retired last year. Now he's written a new memoir. We'll talk with him on the next Fresh Air. We'll also talk with Colson Whitehead about his new novel, Zone One, a post-apocalyptic story set in Manhattan after a plague left the city overrun with zombies. Join us.
And if you've just joined us, Jill Abramson is with me. She was recently named the executive editor of the New York Times, often called the Gray Lady for its eminence in the publishing and news business. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Yet with such an important position, Jill has just published a book. It's titled The Puppy Diaries, Raising a Dog Named Scout. I'm going to go first to South Bend, Indiana, because Chris has a question about his or her older yellow lab. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Diane.
It's a female. Thank you. Go right ahead.
Yes, not so much a question. Just I wanted to share that I have an older yellow lab that we purchased with our children going into a second marriage. As, you know, just really the joining of a family. And that was 9 years ago, and we've just gone through a divorce. And this sweet dog has been my heart through the whole process. You know, at one point, because, forgive me.
No, I totally understand. Go right ahead.
Thank you. At one point, I was so depressed and walking the house, you know, miserable and scared for the future. And my children are now in college at Indiana University. And so it was Jay and I rattling around the house. And I noticed that he was just acting strange. He was very mopey and, you know, laboring, going upstairs to sleep at the foot of my bed and so on. And I became alarmed. He wasn't eating. I took him to the 24-hour, you know, emergency dog care late on a Sunday. And they said, well, he's depressed. You know, he's going through a divorce with you, and he's reflecting your behavior, it appears, you know.
Interesting.
Isn't that amazing?
And that's what happens.
It does. And they can be the most sympathetic kind of companion and friend when you're going through troubles. I actually, your listeners will think I'm a terrible klutz and accident prone, but in the puppy diaries I talk about, after I was recovered, I was at Yellowstone National Park, and I was doing a climb up a very steep ridge. Probably had no business doing that because my sense of balance isn't perfect. But on the way down, I did something common. I slipped on scree and lost my footing and broke my arm. And I was worried when I got home that, you know, Scout, who was 80 pounds and, you know, bundle of energy, that she, you know, would bump into me or jump on me and hurt me. But, you know, she sensed right away that something was wrong.
Really?
And she just, like, spent days curled up at my feet, just like as gentle as can be, and, you know, gave off an aura that was just so comforting.
Well,
and relaxing.
And that's why they become such effective therapy animals.
That's
because
for sure.
They do sense and react very, very favorably. Tell me about the New York Times and how it's changing. There was a recent announcement about the elimination of some positions at the Times.
Yeah, very few, actually. We're going to do some voluntary buyouts. Over the past years, we've had to somewhat reduce our newsroom staff. But actually, right now, it's as large as it was 10 years ago. We still have domestic news bureaus and national correspondents when other so-called national newspapers have really retreated from the major cities in the U.S. And we're a global news gathering organization. We have, you know, more foreign bureaus than we've ever had. We just hired some new correspondents for Afghanistan and Pakistan. But this is a period for the news media broadly of transition, where, you know, we're moving to a world where, you know, more people are reading us on digital platforms and in print form. And we produce the best news report in the world. And, you know, any way someone wants to read it, I'm happy. So, but that means you need somewhat to do less of some things and more of new things. And, you know, you can't just keep growing. It's a tough economy, as we all know.
And, of course, you had Vivian Schiller, who became ultimately the CEO of NPR, who moved from the times where it was she who, I gather, was quite instrumental in developing.
She was.
I
feel she was very much a visionary about the digital world, and you know, helped make our website along with colleagues both on the business side and news side of the Times like a wonder.
You must have been very saddened to have seen what ultimately evolved.
Of course. And I've been in touch with Vivian, and, you know, she's landed on her feet, but it was a sad thing.
Absolutely. To Martha in Lexington, Massachusetts, good morning to you. Martha.
Morning.
Yes.
Yes.
Go right ahead, please.
Well, I'm so fascinated by this, and I'm very tempted to talk about Scout, but my question is really about the Anita Hill era, and I'm wondering if you could comment on the role of the individual as a catalyst for something versus a larger kind of societal trend. I wonder if, I mean, what Anita Hill did was so courageous and an individual act of courage. But at the same time, the times were such that people listened to her and that she felt that it was okay to do that. And I'm wondering about how the press seizes, or maybe not seizes, but acknowledges the contributions of an individual versus the individual being a representative of a larger movement.
Well, you know, I think that Anita Hill, you used the word catalyst, and I think that's a very, very good word. She was. She saw herself, of course, as merely a citizen doing her duty, that she came to Washington, the Judiciary Committee asked her to come, and she testified. And I'm not sure in real time she realized the impact of her testimony and that many women across the world understood what sexual harassment was, but it seemed a new issue to many other people. But I think in terms of your question about the media, that it isn't always a happy experience when someone who isn't a well-known person steps forward in a public way, that they become the focus of attention. In the case of Anita Hill, there was a very sophisticated opposition campaign directed at undermining her. And I think going through that was very bruising.
Here's an email from Clifford, who says, I'm wondering what Mrs. Abramson thinks about the current state of editing. With the great proliferation of news outlets, it seems that editing is becoming a lost art.
Yeah, I don't see that at the Times. And I worked at the Wall Street Journal before the Times, which, you know, had very professional, strict editing, very high standards, as does the Times. But, you know, I think authority, heavily edited journalism is wonderful. It's not the only form. And at the Times, we've learned to take advantage of blogging, which is a little bit more immediate. Our blogs are edited, by the way, and our comments on our site are usually moderated. So it's not the kind of free-for-all you see elsewhere. And we always want the substance of our news report to be as intelligent as our audience is.
Jill Abramson, she's executive editor of the New York Times and the author of a new book. It's titled The Puppy Diaries, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And one question that has been raised a great deal about the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, many other news outlets, and that is the liberal, so-called liberal stance. How do you see it?
You know, I think that the people who see the Times as like a liberal rag are wrong, and that they sometimes don't understand the separation between our opinion side, which produces our editorials and our op-eds, and the news report. They're two different things, and there's separation between the two. And when I worked at the Wall Street Journal, it was known as a conservative newspaper, again, because of the editorial page. But, you know, the news gathering side played it as it was.
And you continue to feel that that's what happens at the Times and at the Wall Street Journal?
I do. I think, you know, the news reporters go into their stories with an open mind. And something I stress to our reporters at the Times is, even when you think you know the story, go in ready to be surprised or illuminated by what somebody tells you.
Here's an email from Carolyn in Washington, D.C. Do you think that having a woman lead a news organization makes a difference? If so, how? Isn't that difference worth recognizing?
I think it is worth recognizing, and I think it's hard for me to talk about women broadly because, you know, I walk in my own skin. But, you know, I think some of the women editors I've worked with are very, very collaborative. They can be strong leaders, but they like bringing in other people and being second-guessed and challenged. And I think I am like that, and that's an important quality if you're the top editor of an important news organization like the Times.
So go through your ordinary day. For me,
my ordinary day begins early in the morning.
What time?
Six. And I have to admit, the first thing I reach for is my iPad, because I usually have been reading it before I go to sleep, too. I mean, I've mainly read all of the front page stories in the Times and many of the other important stories the night before, because we now publish stories when they're ready. And
exactly.
If it's on the website first, that's great.
Right.
So, you know, I look at top stories to see, you know, have I missed anything as news developed overnight? You know, and then I'm just reading, 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 reading. I try and send off some complimentary emails, because I think it's important when you really love something to let the journalist who's created the work know that. And then I get to work. I get to the Times, which is still near Times Square, but in a new building.
That's quite beautiful.
I get there usually, you know, 9-ish. Mm-hmm. And by then I will have, you know, consumed every bit of the Times' news report. I read the Wall Street Journal. I, you know, read the FT, I think is a very good paper.
I fully agree.
My guilty pleasure from the days that I was just growing up in Manhattan on my subway ride is the New York Post. I even look at my horoscope.
Oh, great. As do I, each and every day.
So, you know, I just the early morning is a readathon, and then our first news meeting is at 10. So from 9 to 10, I'm kind of walking the floor and talking to different reporters and editors to try
about
to
what
get
they're working
yeah, what's
on.
Up, and yeah. You know, hoping for big news. And we then go into a 10 a.m. meeting, which is very much about the homepage and what stories will be ready, because we want, you know, our great signature journalism to be, you know, constantly refreshed. And, you know, we now have a digital subscription plan. So our heaviest users are being asked to pay for our journalism, though we still remain part of the free web for many, many people.
Are you involved with lunches each day?
I try to. I had, you know, it's several times a week I have lunches with clusters of reporters or web producers.
Good.
I just had a great lunch. We do sandwiches in my office with some reporters in our sports department, and with the World Series coming up and football season starting and, you know, the terrible racetrack accident.
Oh,
there was plenty to talk about.
I should say. What time do you get home in the evening?
You know, home, I sometimes get home late. Because often there's something at night that I want to do that's work-related.
And
I'm a real culture vulture.
Is Henry with you?
Henry splits his week between our house in Connecticut and New York, and he stays busy. But, you know, I try to get home and spend time with him during the week, and the weekend is really quiet and a sanctuary.
Lovely.
And it's Henry and Scout and I taking the best walks imaginable.
And always Scout. How old is Scout now?
She's 2.5 now.
And a beauty.
She is a beauty and a delight.
Jill Abramson, she's executive editor of the New York Times. She's also a dog lover, as I am, and the author of a new book, The Puppy Diaries, Raising a Dog Named Scout. Thank you for being here.
It's been a joy, Diane.
Thank you. Good to see you again. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we are on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.